The Office of the State Historian is proud to present the New Mexico Digital History Project podcast series.
Good afternoon. My name is Jordan Beltran Gonzalez, and my lecture is entitled Counter Stories of the Bataan Death March from New Mexico and the Philippines. I'd like to begin by thanking you for being here today and for joining me for this talk. I look forward to your feedback and to your questions. I'd like to begin by situating myself and this larger project. The approach that I bring with me to this research is from Filipino-American studies, which is connected to Asian-American studies and ethnic studies. In ethnic studies, I study race, racism, gender, sexism, and mainly power, inequalities of power. When I teach ethnic studies, I often use this quote from one of my favorite professors, George Lipsitz. He asks, "How is racism like a Cadillac?" Racism is like a Cadillac because every year there is a new model. And this is what I bring with me to the approach of history, is looking for the earlier models, the earlier experiences of inequality, particularly around skin color-based discrimination and racism. So that's the approach that I bring with me to history. I'd like to situate myself briefly. I come to this project as a descendant of a Bataan survivor, my grandfather. In Tagalog, we use the term lolo for grandparent, for grandfather. And my lolo was a survivor, and I myself have come into this research very committed to understanding his experiences and the experiences of the women and men who survived or who died. And for so much of their lives, so many of them rarely talked about this history. And with all respect, I'd like to learn more about that silence and about that experience that they've had. For the last several years, my mother and I have participated in several organizations, heritage societies, particularly with the Philippine Scouts, as well as with New Mexico, which has a unique, deep connection to the Bataan Death March. So I'd like to begin the presentation by pointing you toward my larger questions that have guided me in this research. My first question is, how were New Mexico's National Guard soldiers portrayed in their military service during World War II? Newspapers, public records, any types of correspondence, how were they represented in this journey they took from New Mexico to the Philippines? How did this portrayal, how did this representation compare with that of Filipinos? And finally, in addition to this mainstream portrayal and the mainstream representation of New Mexicans and of Filipinos, are there counter stories in the archives? And by counter stories, I refer to narratives and experiences that challenge what we most often hear about World War II. So that's the nature of my presentation today, is presenting the backdrop of World War II, as well as any traces, any evidence of these stories. An author who I rely upon to help me set up this project is an anthropologist from Haiti. Michel Rolf Trio presents a discussion of history that I find fascinating, and I recommend this book, Silencing the Past, Power and the Production of History. Trio presents a discussion of history that opens up, for me, a conversation about how history is. both as a form as well as an interpretation. He uses the term historicity, and he gives it two numbers, historicity 1 and historicity 2. And for this presentation, I want to explain what I mean with those, because that then sets up my archival research. Historicity 1, the form of history, means simply what happened. The question, what happened? That's what often brings us into the search of history, the exploration of the archives. And what I have found here in New Mexico, and what will very much be the focus of my own dissertation, is the second layer to history. Historicity too, the interpretation of history. In other words, that which is said to have happened, the stories we tell about the past. And as you'll see with one of my slides, I'd like to talk about how we remember the past, specifically through memorials. Because of New Mexico's unique participation in World War II, this state has more than 36 official memorials for Bataan and for World War II. And I'm fascinated by the process of memorializing events in the past. So for my dissertation, I'd like to propose another layer of this, which has to do with remembering the past. But for today, we're just going to focus on what happened and the stories we tell, and that difference in between, that slip sometimes between that what happened and the portrayal of it. So now I'd like to direct your attention to Southeast Asia. In particular, the 7,000 islands and the more than 80 ethnic and linguistic groups that comprise the Philippines. To the north of the Philippines, approximately, is Japan. To the south is Indonesia, and of course, across the Pacific is Hawaii and the United States. And I mention these particular places and regions because of the Philippines' strategic location. First, for the colonial Spain for more than 350 years, from the mid-1500s all the way till the end of the 1800s, and then, for today's discussion, for the United States as well as for Japan. The strategic location of the Philippines is crucial. Specifically, the northernmost island of the Philippines is Luzon. The southern portion of Luzon features Bataan, a peninsula just across Manila Bay from the Philippines' capital, Manila. Across the 217 miles of Luzon, in the end of 1941, Japan's Imperial Army trekked and battled U.S. and Filipino soldiers. And what I hope to show you a little bit today is how some of those soldiers were represented in popular media and what some of their experiences were like based on what I found here in Albuquerque as well as in Santa Fe. But before I do that, I'd like to give you a brief timeline of the United States and Philippine history. From 1899 until 1902, we have the official agreed upon dates of the Philippine-American War, exactly following the Spanish-American War and Spain's war for independence from Spain, the Philippines' war for independence from Spain. The Philippines revolted against the United States, claiming its independence. Now, although the date here ends with 1902, the unofficial war continued until 1913. The second date I have is 1934, the Tidings-McDuffie Act. This date signified the beginning of the Philippines' 10-year timeline for independence, beginning in 1934, planned for 1944. This all changed with World War II. 1941 to 1945, World War II. 1 year after World War II ended, in 1946, we have two major events. The Rescission Act, passed in February of 1946, as well as Philippine independence. The Rescission Act will come up later today in my lecture. The subject of the Rescission Act is the independence of the Philippines at the expense of all of the Philippine soldiers from the Philippine Scouts and the Philippine Army receiving any veterans benefits from the United States. Only in February of this year, 2009, did President Obama and U.S. Congress pass a veterans benefits bill to grant veterans who are still alive benefits and recognition. So the U.S. history in the Philippines is complicated. The larger theme I'd like to present to you today is colonialism. Colonialism through two major branches of both capitalism and military conquest. What I describe as militarism, an all-encompassing framework that included not only military, but also labor, military service, and this secondary status that veterans have received for their entire experiences in the Philippine Army. The exploitation of the Philippines involves labor in three major branches, one of which I'll focus on today. Briefly, though, education, social, and military factors are important frameworks to look at. Anyone studying Philippine-American history needs to look at both education, social and cultural factors, as well as the military. In terms of education, the United States set up schools, English language programs, and specifically trained generations of women and men to be doctors and nurses, primarily for importation into the U.S. as a colony. In terms of social and cultural factors, the United States approached the Philippines with the policy of benevolent assimilation, to be included only through the exclusion of Philippine identity and culture and the acceptance of United States culture and identity. We can see this through their status politically as neither citizens nor aliens, but only nationals, a status that permitted Filipinos to emigrate from the Philippines and into the U.S. for the first half of the 20th century without the same exclusion that other Asians or other immigrants faced. Colonialism in the Philippines took the focus of military in a very pivotal way throughout World War II, and this is the focus of today's lecture. Some examples of that are Clark and Subic bases, which remain in the Philippines today, still polluting the land with environmental problems, as well as clashes between the military and the civilian populations. Military service for tens of thousands of Philippine scouts and even more Philippine Army members. And again, the 1946 Rescission Act, denying Filipinos veterans status. So what I'd like to focus on today is how Filipinos experienced World War II in the Philippines, specifically with Bataan. So, in 1941, December 41, one day after Pearl Harbor was bombed by Japan's Air Force, on December 7th of 1941, Japan's planes began bombing Luzon, southern Luzon, near Manila, just north of Manila. There were two locations that they primarily bombed. The next day, Japan's Imperial Army invaded northern Luzon and began to make its way south. About 2 weeks later, on December 23rd, Filipino and U.S. forces were outnumbered and understaffed with resources, under-resourced by the U.S. military. There were several reasons for this, primarily the Philippines' colonial status granted it less important priority than other war efforts going on. So the retreat southward began toward the southern end of Luzon, in particular Bataan. By March 11th, we have General MacArthur making his famous speech, "I Shall Return," where he promised the Philippines and he promised Filipinos that he would return with more supplies to rescue the Philippines. He retreated to Australia to regroup and gather supplies. And on April 9th, we have the beginning of the Bataan Death March. The Bataan Death March began on April 9th when General Edward King surrendered to the Japanese on the island of Luzon in southern Luzon at Bataan. The death march began with approximately 65 to 75 miles, depending on where soldiers were picked up, headed northward to Camp O'Donnell. Camp O'Donnell became one of several prisoner of war camps throughout World War II. Just shortly after Bataan fell, in early May, Corregidor fell. These were the two remaining holdouts for the United States and Filipinos on the island of Luzon. Effectively conquested, the island of Luzon fell, and this is when the death march began. And I'm interested now in how we can understand this history, which has been well covered in many secondary sources generally. But what I find lacking is specific coverage of veterans from different racial and ethnic groups who served in those forces. We have U.S. soldiers and we have Filipinos, but we rarely have a breakdown based on race and ethnicity. And the archives are thorough, but they are not definitive. And what I find lacking are specific details about soldiers of color. So my method for uncovering what some of their stories are is a method called triangulation. And what I mean by triangulation is that I mean to apply and to combine several research methods in the study of the same phenomenon. So I'm going to use media resources from newspapers and periodicals, specifically from scrapbooks collected during World War II, as well as some oral histories and some other documents, correspondence in particular from Governor Miles and Senator Dennis Chavez, with constituents here in New Mexico. What I'd like to do with this is to present to you some of the complicated relationships between reality, what happened, and how that reality is represented, the stories we tell about what happened. So in that difference, I hope to offer a few of the complicated layers of history. First, I'd like to point your attention to New Mexico's Native Americans and their service specifically with New Mexico's National Guard in the 200th Coastal Artillery, which sent more than 2,000 soldiers to the Philippines in 1941, more than 1,800 of whom began the death march in 1942. And when the Philippines was liberated from Japan's hands in 1945, fewer than half of them, fewer than 900, came back to New Mexico. So I'd like to look at the specific involvement of New Mexico's Native Americans in that experience. And I'd also like to look at Filipinos who served in the Philippine Scouts and the Philippine Army as well. So my first example has to do with New Mexico's Native Americans. I have four examples. This example highlights issues of Orientalism and war. The larger theme I'm working with here is that the United States operates through a military framework that very much justifies the persistence of military in U.S. history as well as in the present. So with these examples from the archives, I'd like to show that framework just a little bit. So the first line I have here is context, the reality, the what happened. The context of the late 1930s in New Mexico was like very much of the United States, still recovering from the Great Depression. What we have in particular with Native Americans, what I'd like to show you with some documents here, is low socioeconomic status, limited job opportunities, reliance on government commodities, and a lack of resources. There had been a drought recently in the late 1930s. So first, to begin, I would like to point your attention to some correspondence that I found between Governor Miles, the United States Secretary of Agriculture, United States Indian Commissioner, as well as the New Mexico Association on Indian Affairs. In these letters, we have some very explicit portrayals of how much struggle was happening throughout New Mexico, specifically on the Pueblos and among Native Americans. And I raise this issue because I'd like to look at the experiences that soldiers were leaving when they joined the military. What made them join? What were some of the factors that made them embark on a military journey? New Mexico Association on Indian Affairs, 1939, October. A letter to the Department of Agriculture's Secretary, Wallace. Dear Mr. Secretary, there are thousands of Navajo Indians and their stock in serious danger of starvation due to the almost unprecedented drought of this summer. In some sections of the reservation, there was no rainfall from February to mid-September of 1939. Corn and wheat flour from surplus commodities could save them if it were possible to secure sufficient quantities before winter. We are, therefore, writing to ask if you could have regulations set aside in this instance permitting Superintendent Fryer to obtain enough food to ensure that there will be no starvation on the reservation this winter, either among the stock or among the human beings. Okay, so this is some correspondence identifying the critical lack going on in New Mexico. Governor Miles to the same secretary. 1 month later, November 1939. I am advised that it would be dangerous to continue the allotments through the winter months on this basis on account of heavy snows and inclement weather, which will make it impossible for the Indians to get in and out of the reservation. Reply 1 week later from the secretary. The Federal Surplus Commodities Corporation and the Office of Indian Affairs have agreed for surplus commodities donated to Gallup, New Mexico, and to be distributed throughout New Mexico. Now, I don't have proof that this is exactly what caused people to join the military, but I just want to highlight a little bit of the context that people were coming from. And this dialogue continues. We have a letter. We have a letter from San Rafael from a man, Jose Loretto, who talks about the poverty that his family lives with and the difficulty of surviving, and therefore their commitment to hold out for any supplies that Governor Miles can supply. And as some of you know, in the late 1930s, New Mexico had a very dynamic program called the Civilian Conservation Corps. Has anyone ever heard of it? The Civilian Conservation Corps? Okay, this is a program funded by federal monies, much like the Works Progress Administration, to offer training and jobs for work to be done that would improve land, parks and recs, as well as just overall civil society. Well, I'm fascinated by the Civilian Conservation Corps because of its demographics, as well as the directions that people went after the program ended. After the program ended in 1940, because of the needs for resources to be directed toward the war efforts. And I have an article here from the Albuquerque Journal, early in 1942, identifying the direct connection between the Civilian Conservation Corps and military service. Now, by the sheer timeline, these soldiers who went into the military could not have been in the Philippines on Bataan. They could not have been. By then, they were already trained and fighting against the Japanese soldiers in early 1942, but this is still context for the beginning of a very long war effort in which many, many, many Native Americans, as well as U.S. overall, enlisted in the military. But I find this fascinating. February 1942, the plan of Adjutant General New Mexico, General Charlton, to salvage quote-unquote forgotten youths, those who have been rejected for military service, by making themselves fit by 6 months' service in the Civilian Conservation Corps, gets the approval of the ancient city legionnaire. So this is a documentation of connections between civilian service, training, and then military service. In New Mexico, illiteracy is one of the major factors in rejecting youths for military service. Neither the Army nor the Navy wants such men. Persons who are unable to read or write cannot be depended upon to understand and carry out orders. These deficiencies are quickly overcome through standardized courses in all Civilian Conservation Corps camps. And I'd like to point your attention now to an article I found entitled, Indians Are Rushing to Defense of the U.S. Through Industry and Army. Now, this is coverage. This is portrayal of Native Americans, as opposed to a denial or an exclusion of Native Americans. So on the outset, this appears to be coverage. This appears to be evidence of their participation in the war. What I find challenging about this newspaper article is that it does not question the fact that the Civilian Conservation Corps and military service were so closely linked. Rather, it looks at them as a smooth, without problematic relationship. For example, America's entrance into the war found many young and old Indians already engaged in varied defense activities at home, while thousands of young braves had joined the Army or found employment in defense industries. Almost 800 Civilian Conservation Corps workers are enrolled in defense training courses in 11 different states. 5 Navajo families who were recently awarded $15,000 as compensation for the death of 6 Indian children invested that money in defense bonds. And this article goes on to describe the relationship between Civilian Conservation Corps and Native Americans and this almost willful participation in World War II efforts. And the challenge here is that they're not digging beneath the surface. And that's my job, of course, as a historian, is to understand that relationship between the context and this notion that military service is a choice for everyone made equally. In contrast, I put forth the thesis that Native Americans, like so many other lower-income Latino, Hispanic, Chicano, Mexicano, as well as lower-income white servicemen, joined the military out of necessity. And it's a topic that rarely gets described when we talk about history. It's so rich with detail when we look for it in the archives, and yet when we tell history, even with our monuments, it often portrays the larger banner of American patriotism. And with or without questioning that patriotism, it's important for us to look at that context. For example, in July of 1942, we have articles in both the Albuquerque Journal as well as the Chicago Sun. These stem from a scrapbook, I should tell you. These stem from a scrapbook I found of World War II newspaper articles in Santa Fe, in the state records collection from the Adjutant General. So these are recorded newspaper articles set already in a scrapbook. And what we have is a description of Redskin Patriots. That's the title. Redskin Patriots. 8,000 Indians are now in the U.S. Army. Now, the description here is, again, of inclusion and of detail about Native Americans. From the outset, it seems great. There's coverage. There's evidence. But again, the very, very one-sided portrayal of Native Americans as only patriotic, as only volunteering, misses the larger picture. We have here a description of several prominent members of Congress have maintained that the Indians' eagerness to serve in the Army is a tribute to their patriotism and to the spirit of America's original inhabitants. It is a grand show of loyalty, said Senator Charles McNary of Oregon. After the injustices the Indians has suffered, he is still ready to fight for America because he knows that only under democracy can injustices be remedied. Under fascism and Nazism, the Indian would be crushed along with all other lovers of liberty. The article then goes on to describe Native Americans in a very specific way. Not as whole people, but rather as sum totals of special skills. And I think this is a very profound way that racism works. It separates people into parts, and it divides us from our whole human. special skills. The value of American Indians to the Army is underscored by certain special skills to which the Indians claim heritage. As scouts, runners, and in signal work, they excel. They can slip silently and swiftly through the wilderness areas which the Army must defend in the far west and in Alaska. The activities of the famous Indian scouts have called the attention to the nation, to the role of Indians in the work of the Army. So again, we get this racialization of skills. And finally, a description here in the New Mexican, in the Santa Fe New Mexican, in August of 42, continues to highlight the participation of Native Americans currently in the war, as well as the increasing numbers of Native Americans enlisting in the war efforts. Pueblo Indian captures corporation. Although it has been centuries since the Pueblos fought a war, Private Octavio Suina, now with an infantry training battalion at Camp Roberts, California, has shown that the Braves have lost none of their warriors' skills, according to a news story from that camp. He said, this news story, it says, Private Suina not only proved the company that a patrol can advance quietly in search of the enemy, but also he captured a prisoner who was concealed in the darkness. So this idea that there's an essence of warrior among Native Americans that propels them to serve, of course, raises red flags when we look at history, because we're, again, avoiding that context. And the portrayal of Native Americans as stealth and being able to see in the dark downright relegates them to non-human and some sort of animalistic capacities. And finally, I have Indian Commissioner John Collier from Washington, D.C., praising Native Americans. And it's a powerful phenomenon when praise works to reinforce these inequalities. For example, U.S. Indians are volunteering, quote, more generously than any other population group in the nation, Indian Commissioner Collier reports. Here on what he termed a, quote, unquote, periodical visit, Collier said Indians were not only entering military service in unprecedented numbers, but were contributing on a similar scale to all other phases of wartime support. Individual and tribal monies are being invested in defense bonds and contributed to the Red Cross and similar campaigns, he added. So there's no discussion of the general context that Native Americans are living in. We only see their wartime patriotism. Down to a New Mexican New Mexico Magazine article highlighting one particular Native American who tried to enlist five times only to have medical issues keep him from enlisting. Only on his sixth time does he receive acceptance into the U.S. military. And this way of describing months and months and months of persistence gives us a very skewed perception of Native Americans and their reasons for participating. Several other articles highlight the Native Americans' willingness to participate in the war effort by scrap metals. Scrap metals and other wartime resources that were scarce. I found one that was very telling. It's titled Iron Mountain and Squaw Put Navajos into the Scrap. The issue here is scarce wartime resources and the incentives to get Native Americans to donate. A lot of patriotic Indians stuck with a large junk pile because, as usual, the ingenious Navajos were able to solve another problem. Some tribal Thomas Edison, whose name had been overlooked in the report, stepped up to the chief in charge of junk collection and made a suggestion. We don't know how much the old iron weighs, but we do know how much Leaping Doe weighs. She weighs 250 pounds in her moccasins, right on the dot. She has no value as old iron, said the chief in charge of junk collection. Perhaps not, admitted the Indian Edison. But she weighs just as much as 250 pounds of it, and that is the point I'm trying to make. Let us fix up a teeter-totter. So even in their attempts to participate in the war effort, Native Americans are portrayed as of subferior intelligence and unable to come up with a way to measure iron than to have one of their sisters stand on a teeter-totter. highlighted along with a propensity to dance, as well as being impulsive and not frugal, I hope that these images paint a little bit of a picture of the skewed perceptions, again, of Native Americans. Now, in addition to these representations of Native Americans, it's important to highlight the very real results of the Bataan Death March and of the Battle for Bataan. New Mexico's National Guard soldiers, in general, especially though Navajos, died at extremely high rates during the Death March and at the prisoner of war camps. Approximately 1/4 to 1/3 of the soldiers died during the march, and many, many more died during the camps. Those who survived and returned back to New Mexico, only about 1 in 3 lived after returning to New Mexico after the war efforts because of dehydration, starvation, and a lack of any resources during those years. So those who survived did not necessarily last very long. And a scholar, Eva Jane Mattson, whose work It Told for New Mexico, has a very, very helpful way of identifying the data about these mortality rates. Mattson describes the rates of enlistment and the rates of returning home, and she identifies those who, of course, died in Bataan and subsequently. What she does then is a breakdown of race and ethnicity in terms of these war survivors and those who died. And she identifies almost identical rates of surviving for all of the New Mexico soldiers. In particular, though, one exception is for Navajos. Of the 27 Navajos who were with the 200th Coastal Artillery from New Mexico, 24 of them died. So 8 out of 9, almost all, and almost double the rates of survival for other New Mexicans. So we see the extremely high death rates of all New Mexicans, in particular Navajos. When we factor in issues of rank and status in the military, you can make an argument that soldiers of color, who often had the lower ranks, not as officers, faced a particular burden during the death march, as the officers themselves had a slightly different treatment. I found some really good archival documents about some of the bitterness, some of the harsh bitterness that some of these survivors had toward their officers because of the different treatment they experienced. So without indulging in this game of oppression Olympics, we can still identify a slightly different experience among Navajos during the death march, even amidst a stark experience for everyone. And yet, the challenge with my research now is explaining how that reality is represented, how the what happened question with death rates is represented with the stories we tell. And in southern New Mexico, at an event that I participate in annually, there's a statue entitled Heroes of Bataan. The Heroes of Bataan here are based on the likenesses of 3 descendants. Actually, 1 descendant, Gilbert Canuela, who is a descendant of a Philippine scout, whose likeness is in the middle, and the lives that are actually survivors that are represented here are on the ends, Juan and Pepe Baldonado. And one of their descendants, Joe Martinez, helped initiate this statue. And this statue here represents the inclusion of both Hispanic and Latino and Mexicano soldiers, as well as Filipinos. So I find this progressive and inclusive because it does not have only a plaque, it has a representation. But the ethnicity that is missing here are Native Americans. And to me, I hope that we can amend our monuments in the future to include the very people who participated in these events. In their defense, the Las Cruces Convention and Visitors Bureau describes this as based on a real event. A real event of the Maldonados carrying a Philippine soldier, and therefore it's based on that exact moment in history. And yet, the potential here for not including the very participants in history in a representation of it has some very dangerous consequences for future students, anyone who sees this memorial, not seeing the full story of participation in the war. I'd like to point your attention to another example of Philippine scouts and Philippine Army in the larger framework of United States colonization. In the framework of United States colonization, we have this logic, this operating logic that Andrea Smith describes as a logic of disappearance. Indigenous peoples must always be disappearing in order to allow non-Indigenous peoples rightful claim over this land. Indigenous peoples must always be disappearing in order to allow non-Indigenous people rightful claims over this land. And Filipinos in the archives are represented as secondary and as inferior. Secondary to United States and inferior to Europeans and United States Americans. One of the examples I found with this is that even in the Bataan Death March, marching side by side, Filipinos are represented as primitive and with a backwards status. General King, the commanding officer of the United States in the Philippines, is describing the death march when he's released from captivity. General King describes this. With specific, very specific details about Filipinos and U.S. soldiers enduring the death march together. But when he describes Filipinos, he describes their willingness to bury their dead as a primitive form of civilization, in contrast to the Americans who bury their dead fully clothed. And it's a very subtle, very slight way in which he distinguishes these tendencies, these cultural practices. So this is my first example of the portrayal of Filipinos. There were close to 50,000 Filipino soldiers with us, and we saw them burying their dead naked. Prisoners had to dig the graves, but the ground was too hard to dig deep enough for safety. So it was not unusual to see dogs digging up the bodies at night and tearing them apart. We had to bury our dead too, and until a man buries another under these conditions, no amount of imagining can measure the horror of the experience. We dressed our men and gave them a burial as nearly American and as humanly as possible under conditions there. So he's portraying a terrible situation. And in that situation, Filipinos are distinguished apart from U.S. An example of this continues in the notion that Filipinos are primitive and that they need to be trained in modern business. In particular, by U.S., as well as other Filipinos who've also experienced U.S. policies. The Filipinos who gradually paid their way out received long training in modern business that qualified them for its emergencies. Their farms were saved, and they were able to turn to the mills for valuable assets. So again, reliance upon the colonizer. Even in their descriptions of heroics and valor during the death march, during the defense of Bataan, Filipinos are portrayed through words like wild, fierce, and bloody fighters. In fact, they're not even described in one article as Filipinos, but rather as the tribes, peoples who comprise the Philippines and who are often referred to as the primitive Filipinos. So I'm looking for evidence of any kind of derogatory descriptions of Filipinos in the archives. Even in their descriptions of military service, we again see that pattern of volunteerism. Filipinos volunteering for the military through duty and through loyalty and patriotism. This picks up upon Rudyard Kipling's poem from the end of the 1800s, the beginning of the 1900s, The White Man's Burden, which claimed that it was which claimed the United States' duty to colonize and civilize the Philippines. And amidst all of these portrayals, I found an article in March of 1942, 2 weeks prior to the surrender of Bataan to the Japanese army, in which a recommendation of Douglas MacArthur, as well as Secretary of State Henry Stimson, suggested to U.S. Congress that Filipinos receive larger veterans' benefits than they had initially been promised because of their service to the U.S. During World War II, General MacArthur and the U.S. advocated for these increased compensations based on their duty and based on their heroics. The former Philippine Army is now in service of the U.S. Armed Forces, Mr. Stimson said. It has been recommended by General MacArthur that by reason of the equalization that battle has imposed upon all classes of personnel engaged in combat in the Bataan Peninsula, and further, in the interest of sustaining high battle morale among all these troops, the pay of all personnel concerned should be the same while they are taking the same risks. Now that is an example of what happened, a debate during World War II of increased benefits and recognition for Filipinos because of their service to the U.S. And I contrast that with the reality after World War II in 1946, the United States denying veterans benefits or veterans recognition, including citizenship, to the very same peoples. 66 allied countries received veterans recognition, except for the Philippines. And it was not until 2009, 63 years later, that Filipinos were granted this recognition. And that example highlights the continued colonial status of the Philippines and the exploitation of their labor. The limitations and boundaries of this project are many. Based on what is found in the archives, I have been able to unearth some of the narratives, some of the stories here. But with archives comes a certain degree of inclusion, and little by little, we can chip away at that to include even more. What I mean by that is that not everything that happened has been identified as an archive. So we're left with these traces of the past, but unless we use alternative methods and creative ways of identifying oral histories or other stories, we're looking for things that were not necessarily documented. Many of these veterans were not interviewed, and for many of them, participation in the United States has been at many costs. So with more to explore in Las Cruces next week at New Mexico State, as well as at Fort Bliss after that in El Paso, I realize I have much more to gain. The way that this all works in my dissertation is part of the setup for an oral history project. What has not been done enough of is interviews with Filipinos who were fighting alongside the U.S. soldiers. Much laudable research has been done and is still being done on New Mexican soldiers, and I'd like to look at some of the relationships that Filipinos forged with those soldiers since their high in years and age, and since their lives are passing right now, it's important that we do what we can to interview them. I'd like to make a few acknowledgments here, specifically to the librarians and to the offices that have helped me the most, which has been everyone. But first, I'd like to start with the New Mexico Office of the State Historian. We have Dennis and Bonnie and Esteban are not here today. At the State Records Collection and Archives in Santa Fe, Felicia, Samuel, and Al are oracles of information and of knowledge. Here, Nancy, Beth, as well as Anne have been very helpful in helping me identify specific files. If there's anything I can tell other archivists is to not reinvent the wheel and to rely upon the good graces and the good work that's been done in front of us, as well as at the Social Science Research Council. And I dedicate this to the person who's inspired me for this research, my grandfather, my Lolo. Ludovico Beltran passed before I ever had a chance to talk with him about this. And I think that for so many of us in this generation, World War II is a topic that has maybe come up in some conversation, if at all, but some of the deeper, more critical questions we can ask about it have yet to be asked. And in my case, I was unable to ask. Because of my own young age, as well as because of his silence. So it's my goal to help understand why those silences happened after the war, why people maintained such a willingness to ally with other veterans, and perhaps a lack of critique of the very experiences that they endured. So I'm trying to open up some of those stories. Anyway, I'd like to hear some of your questions, some of your feedback. Yes. Some of them do exist. That's my first response, but they're scattered. Okay. They're scattered, right. Some of their stories do exist, but they're scattered. There are some oral history projects that have been conducted, but the questions I'm asking are not necessarily the ones that the oral historians had asked, right? Explicit questions about racism are not things that I found yet. So I can point you to some of those.
Any idea of why they survived versus why their compatriots did not?
I couldn't even begin to speculate. I think that many of the archives that I looked at really have to do with camaraderie and a particular characteristic that sometimes gets romanticized, but a particular characteristic of New Mexicans allying together, as opposed to trying to march alone or to survive alone. So despite the romanticization of that history, there's definitely some parallels with historic connections across New Mexico. Farming communities working together over the years, just the unique difference that they experienced being so far from New Mexico really brought them together. There's a tremendous amount of pride among the 200th Coastal Artillery, not only for their anti-aircraft skills, but also for their elitism, the fact that they were chosen to go defend the Philippines among all the other National Guard regiments, I think brought them to a level of social and spiritual fortitude, where they didn't, there's so many examples, guys who started social networks, newspapers, anything they could do to maintain some degree of sanity together. But it could have been just downright luck and fortune, depending on the goodwill of someone who gave you some food from a nearby Filipino town when you were marching by, or being spared a bayonet. I mean, the stories are profound. But they all suffered so much in terms of starvation and dehydration. It's hard to tell if there's any, like, practical reason why anyone survived more than another. Yeah.
A couple of questions tied in. If you know this, how many total started out in the Death March? Mm-hmm. And that 70-plus miles or so, how long did it take them to move?
Yeah.
Well, I understand it's not hundreds of miles. Prisoners along that route?
Yeah, it's debated. It's interesting. It's debated. Somewhere estimated between 65 and 75,000. About 13,000 U.S. and about approximately 60,000 Filipinos, civilians included to some extent. Approximately 6 to 9 days. But when some people were picked up a little bit later, it might have been a shorter march. But about that second week of April, from the 9th until about the 16th or 17th, that's when you generally see it. And then they got to Camp O'Donnell.
And you were mentioning the burials, or attempts to bury them. Was there ever later, because military, even now with Vietnam, is attempting to recover, was there a recovery?
Good question.
Recreation of any of the bodies, particularly in America, it seems to be.
There are military tours, which isn't exactly that topic, but there are expeditions people take to learn more about the locations and the history. I don't know about a recovery effort in terms of actual remains or actual evidence. I do know that there are quite a few artifacts or notes or any kinds of U.S. materials that were buried before they surrendered that are still coming unearthed. People wrote notes. People wrote field notes that, of course, they didn't want to get into the Japanese army's hands, and so they buried them. So there's still farmers throughout Bataan who uncover and unearth all of these archives, basically, that are buried.
And then the other point, and I'm not quite sure if I understand this, so I might be passing on my confusion. I've spoken with some of the Tom Denmark survivors. Mm-hmm. We have a Heiner River that might be in some of it. One made a comment that he was kind of grateful for the racism of the military because they were a segregated unit and that put New Mexicans with common experience and survival skills together and contributes their ability to survive because they were together. But I don't know if that's necessarily the racism because they went as a National Guard unit, you would register it to your National Guard unit based upon where you come from.
Right.
And not necessarily just enlist in the military and get sent out as part of some of those units. So I don't deny the racism of this country or the military, but it wouldn't necessarily seem to me to be the reason that they stayed segregated. It would be based upon where they came from.
That's great. I'd like to talk with you more about that. It's powerful when the very system that enacts inequality becomes something that people find some sort of sense in a way, you know, in the sense that the racism that even led to the war or the racism that had led to the organization of that, it even becomes something that people find a way to heal with, you know, almost a way to process this trauma is to find a way to make sense of it. For example, if I endured this, then I have to find a way to make sense of it. Not that I know the particular persons that you're talking with. It's just the persistence of inequality through that.
With the lack of making sense of it at a personal level, be part of the silence. I can understand somebody is, as we know in trauma, people that are victimized by sexual crimes or abuse of children, that silence is a big piece. I don't understand the difference in that silence because even with the Navajo code talkers who have now come into some recognition, but some of them do share, and I've spoken with some of them, Senator John P. W. Warren, that harder to endure than the fight against the enemy that they understood was the racism that they had to endure from their fellow soldiers.
Right.
But that was a daily battle, not the Japanese, but their battle was the ridicule and the treatment that they had.
Yeah, these are great questions. These are exactly the kinds of questions I'd like for oral history projects, and this starts with me, right, to embark upon, you know, with sensitivity and because of the age of the elders as well as my own lack of experience with the military, how do I not step on anyone's toes, but at the same time ask them to unlock these questions? And these are not necessarily the questions I find in the oral histories. That's what I find challenging. And to add to the layers that you're pointing out in terms of racism, I think the lack of being able to even talk about this with anyone when they got back, that's something I found too, is the reasons for silence among the veterans are many. There are many reasons for their silence, but the lack of even being able to talk about this trauma with anyone, except for fellow Bataan survivors, across racial and ethnic lines, because of just how stark and how extreme it was. I can kind of see that, you know. Again, without knowing the exact conversations you're referring to, I think it points to a psychological analysis. I think it's a great point you bring up, just how people make sense of something that's senseless. Charles?
Do you have a breakout of the ethnicity of the 200?
I don't have it in front of me. Ava Matson has it. Ava, E-V-A, Jane Matson, M-A-T-S-O-N. And I appreciate her work because she talks about the participation across ethnic and racial lines. What I'd like to do is open that conversation up to a bit more of the experiences they had based on that ethnic and racial representation.
Let me just first introduce myself, and you'll understand the context that I'm coming from. My name is Ed Popola.
Oh, great.
And I am a professor here in the School of Architecture and Planning. But it was really the result of a couple of things that emerged in my life. One is I'm married to a Filipina, and my father-in-law is a survivor of the Autumn Death March. But more than that, I did a studio way back in 1998, I believe, where we began to start the wheels turning that ultimately manifested in the dedication of the memorial here at the park. So I currently sit on the foundation for the regular Memorial Foundation. And I actually had a project on oral histories and have done video interviews with many of the death survivors, including Native Americans. I guess my kind of reaction is that there's an incredible amount of complexities with regards to the staging of the events that sort of coalesce. I think racism is kind of one thread of it, but my overall impression and conclusion of having had a chance to sort of immerse myself in a lot of this is that the racism was really an American artifact in the sense of the fact that it existed and still continues to persist within this country simply because of the fact that I would say a large amount of the American populace somehow still considers themselves to be a privileged class. And they've never gotten over that. It was manifested in the earliest Spanish colonial kind of episode, and then it persisted into the American territorial period, and then it influenced what occurred after people got resettled here. But on the other hand, the experience of the survivors, that's the only voices we know since we don't know the ones that didn't survive, is that, in fact, in particular, the experience of the New Mexicans was really, really unique in the sense of the fact that many of them were people of color. And when they got thrown into that arena, they actually had a slightly better edge of being able to survive simply because the Filipino people themselves identified them almost as their own, because they looked like them. And in fact, one of the comments that I remembered in my interviews was they said they're just like us. And that was kind of a reciprocal kind of perception that they had when they were trying to survive that particular episode. And certainly from the veterans that I interviewed in the Philippines who had looked at the Americans there, they really felt a high degree accessibility, you know, they were the right age to go into military service at that point. And some of the conversations that I've had is that they were actually protected for at least a year from entering into service so that they could finish their school, and that part of the mobilizing of the Code Talkers was really on the basis of already anticipating that they had a distinct kind of role, that they could serve in the armed forces that was different from any of the other particular groups. Of course, Navajo being a dominant group in terms of demographics, that's why the language and the number of soldiers that they could enlist was larger than any of the other groups, because if you compare them with the Pueblos, for example, you're talking hundreds as opposed to thousands of Navajos. The other thing is, from the standpoint of that affinity, once they were cornered and they were basically surrendered, and they talk about that a lot, the fact that they felt that they had been betrayed, and in particular, a lot of the veterans absolutely hate MacArthur to this very day, because it was bad enough that he left them to fend for themselves, but all during this period, he kept communicating with General King that they were going to deploy a liberation force, which never came. So they kind of withstood the barrage of all the sort of Japanese on defending their area in expectation that any day there was going to be relief, supplies, initially troops. That's what kept their hopes up. And when that didn't forthcome, then obviously when they were surrendered, they really felt that betrayal. So a lot of veterans just to this day hate the guards with passion. So but that camaraderie was, especially amongst the New Mexicans, was so strong, is based on the sort of color circle, that there are other troops who were also Badag survivors from other units throughout the country who then gravitated and formed their own sort of support community within this death survival camp. And one of them in particular, who's still alive today, his name is Alec Matthews, and he's from Oklahoma, and he's a Pawnee Indian. And he actually, to this day, still becomes, is a member of the Special Artillery here in New Mexico, because those were the comrades that he found, that he identified with around the surviving of death camps. So, I mean, I guess I just want to tell you that it's important, I think, to sort of separate this notion of racism on the basis of this kind of unique context and situation. I think it's dominant and prevalent when you talk about it in terms of this sense of the American psyche and epic. But when it was within the campaign over there, that racism really was not the dominant issue at all. There was a lot of structural things that were going over there that were sort of pushing people in sort of different ways according to their own sort of American psychological. But war is war, and when they were out there, they became essentially one of each other, colorless from that sort of standpoint. But nonetheless, they still found affinity amongst themselves in order to be able to suffer.
Yeah.
I mean, the common denominator was just suffering the atrocities that were out there.
Right.
And when they came back, we all really helped each other, whether they were white or Hispano or Native American, to sort of survive the shock of having to be put back into mainstream society. Because again, the other thing that people don't realize is that for all the years that the war actually occurred, they were in prison of war camps. They were not out there fighting.
Right.
So they never had the chance to really sort of push that aggression to fight the enemy one-to-one, because they were liberated. And as soon as they were liberated, then they had to come straight back into the American mainstream and pick up their lives again. Whereas other soldiers in the field would shoot at the enemy and kill them and sort of get their psychological compensation from that, I guess, you know, in terms of their sense of an eye to an eye, that sort of evenness. But these veterans never had that. So, I mean, even within the polarized. Some saying, yeah, it's about time we accept the apology. And then the other one saying, you know, no way in hell is going to go dead, you know, go on
right.
deathbed and never forgive them
for right.
the things that they did. So, I mean, there's all of those things
that yeah. play. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. I've been meaning to meet you, so this is perfect timing. Yeah, it raises powerful questions, and I think really it's that dialogue, like you were pointing to, it's that dialogue or that complexity of questions or complexity of themes that conversations like this can uncover.
Yeah, and I can give you the name of one person in Massachusetts, I think he's still alive, who is one of the last surviving members of the Philippine Calvary.
Oh, Mr. Perazzo.
Yeah,
he's a friend of mine. He's in Dallas now, but we'll talk more about that. Yeah, he's with his family. Yeah. 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 He's real candid, too. He's real conversational. Rosina?
Okay, I know this is
Yeah.
So are they finding these things? How are they visualizing their relationship with the U.S.? How are they visualizing their relationship with these soldiers? How do they visualize their relationship with Japan? Mm-hmm. That would be really powerful to juxtapose with this discussion that you're having about in the U.S. papers. Because if it's more prevalent, that'd be one thing. Even if it's less prevalent, why is that?
Yeah. I appreciate that, Osuna. It's a great suggestion. I'm interested in that, too, especially with this project now really pushing me toward memorials and conversations that we can find about the events that have happened, how we remember, how we narrate those events. It's making me think about that, too. Dennis?
Yeah, George. This is actually another source for you. I don't recall if you were at Jennifer Denandale's talk.
No.
Jennifer is a medical scholar now in Northern Arizona, and as part of her talk, she discussed that characterization of Native people as warriors and how that kind of fits into this colonial mindset and sort of a social engineering whereby that sort of characterization can become a social tool, like a recruiting tool, whereby maybe people characterized as warriors are then easily sort of funneled into the military. The conversation is more complex than that, but she's someone you might want to talk about.
Thank you.
But can I comment on that? There's kind of this kind of strange notion of American Indian as fitting a particular kind of militaristic stereotype. It's this kind of frontier sense, and it always kind of blows me away when you look at, for example, all the hardware that the military made after Indians. The Apache helicopter, and you have a whole bunch of different kinds of things. So I mean, that's squarely within that sort of ethic. So it doesn't surprise me that, you know, in terms of their description, they kind of infer to you from that sort of stereotypic type of shell. So I know in some of my conversations, you know, everybody who joined the military, even to this day, the tendency is for them to call them chief, for example.
Yeah.
And they take, of course, a lot of predilections toward being that. First off, I'm not a chief. Secondly, you know, I'm just as scared as you are, whatever the case may be. There's a definite weirdness there as far as that aspect.
Yeah.
Well, didn't warrior, in terms of the original native languages, it wasn't necessarily literally translated from this original meaning for war. We misinterpret it for war because of the warrior. We see it in the whole name. My understanding for most of the warriors was more of a status of those that serve their people. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, maybe it's a semantic thing that we have attached the war into warrior.
I think it came out of the campaigns of the frontier. Because, you know, this whole Southwest area was the last real staging of the final campaign beginnings of the military. So, you know, the Apaches, the Comanches, to a certain extent, the Navajos, they were all the ones that, essentially, from the standpoint of the so-called tradition of expansionism, that Americans kind of remember as far as being the last of an era. So I think that's projected into today, because sometimes when I listen to the types of way that they describe the campaigns that are currently going on in Afghanistan, for example, they describe themselves as being the same sort of cavalry warriors that are going under the tribes there. You see that same language being projected over there. So it's just that mystery of the nature. It's a racist kind of stereotype video.
Yeah.
But it harkens, I think, for that psyche of being the dominant, being the conqueror, being the ones that save civilization.
Hmm.
Yeah. I mean, something really interesting in my research with the Hikaya Apache, oftentimes the Indian agents would report that the chief wanted peace. They wanted peace. And the attitude of the U.S. was, no, they're being duplicitous. It was as if they didn't want to hear it. And Indian scouts like Bonneville, for example, who worked for the U.S. government, felt like annihilation was the only solution for the Apache.
Yeah. Well, a good example of that related to the culture, this is not a new information topic for you, is that when the American territorial government first went in order to fight the insurgents in the Philippines, they actually recruited Apache scouts, mainly from the White Mountain area in Arizona. They actually took them there to serve as scouts under the with the expectation that while they served great as scouts here against Geronimo and all these other folks, and they would do well under these other native people in the Philippines. And oral history basically says, and I never had a chance to really track this down, that a contingent of them actually stayed there, intermarried in the Philippines. And they became this particular cultural group called the Magabey. And they still are in sort of a defined village area. I don't know how much of the oral history they still retain from that era, but I mean, that's the sort of social dynamic that is, you know, totally, I almost want to say it's almost in the same vein as science fiction, because you never expect something like that to actually occur.
Yeah. There's a long history of U.S. soldiers who defected and fought with the Filipinos, Buffalo soldiers during the Philippine-American War. Erwin?
I mentioned earlier, too, about the bombing shelter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Research funds can go, but it'd be interesting if you get to Japan. But he was telling me of a fascination that even carries over today in the United States. That's why there's such high, I'm using the word, that's kind of this love-hate relationship we have in some of the way of tourists. Tourism. But there's a high number of tourists that do come from Japan for cultural studies, that apparently there were a lot of things written or documented by Japanese guards and soldiers that had to oversee these prisoners of war, and that they spoke of almost of a fascination with the culture of the native, the New Mexicans, Hispanic, and the natives, and a similarity of values to this camaraderie that went beyond just comrades in arms.
Wow.
They saw cultural strengths that they highly regarded and apparently regarded as much as they documented it. I've never seen that. I wanted to hear that from a couple of the Waukesha that spoke of it.